FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, Sunday, November 1st, 2009, here in WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, as our guest, we're going to have someone who's been with us many times before to talk about his new work. Our guest will be Robert Greenwald, filmmaker, maker of many fine documentaries and feature films over the past few decades, talking about Rethink Afghanistan, what's going on there in the broader political scene in the United States today. It should be a wonderful hour, so sit back, relax, and enjoy the show. But before we go to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
Newspapers and commercial broadcast news programs continue to lose both audience and advertisers, and the question of how to support reliable news and investigative reporting looms large. But new models for news gathering are emerging that give hope for the future of news. A new report, The Reconstruction of American Journalism, surveys a wide swath of the journalism landscape and proposes a set of recommendations for going forward in this new era. It was written by Len Downey, former executive editor of The Washington Post, and Michael Schudson, a professor at the Columbia University School of Journalism. Schudson says that there's considerable adverse reaction to the report's endorsement of public policy playing a part in securing journalism's future. But he's seeing signs that many in the industry and in the public sector are beginning to explore the possibilities of government involvement.
I see signs that various people are beginning to make some headway in saying it's more a complicated story than that. It's a more complicated story in our own American history, where government in a variety of ways has, in fact, subsidized the press directly. It's more complicated in other countries that have by no means lost their press freedom and have much, much greater direct government subsidy of the press. The BBC is the world's leading example. And all of this should make people stop and think about whether the traditional reaction to government support of the news media is one that needs rethinking.
Among their recommendations, Schudson and Downey are calling for a change in the tax code to allow newsrooms to operate as nonprofit or low-profit organizations. This would allow them to focus on their news-gathering mission instead of just their stock prices. They also suggest expanding NPR and PBS to focus on local news and accountability journalism. One of their most interesting but controversial proposals is to establish a national fund for local news. Downey explains.
We understand the concerns that people have about it, but we've seen through the National Endowment of the Arts, the National Endowment of Humanities, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Institutes of Health, the National Science Foundation, that by and large, on balance, these things work. They're not without problems. Nevertheless, on balance, they work. And we think that the fund for local news would work, too. But on the other hand, we welcome the debate over it so we can work out the issues that would be necessary in order for it to happen.
To read The Reconstruction of American Journalism, go to the Columbia Journalism Review at cjr.org.
In the United States, the op-ed pages of newspapers and Sunday morning political talk shows are dominated by a narrow section of society, mostly white and 85% male. Journalist and author Catherine Orenstein started the Op-Ed Project to expand public debate by expanding the pool of women experts that contribute to our nation's key print and online forums.
The submission ratio at the Washington Post last year, just for example, was 9-1. 90% of the submissions to that enormously, enormously powerful page came from men, which means that editors don't have a lot of women to choose from. And I thought, isn't the obvious solution to start getting more women, more smart women submitting?
The Op-Ed Project trains women experts in all fields to write for the op-ed pages of major newspapers and contribute their ideas to the public discourse in other ways. They work with top universities, nonprofits, corporations, women's organizations, and community leaders to help women channel their voices into online forums, TV and radio, board meetings, PTA meetings, or the steps of Congress.
We're using op-ed as a metaphor for teaching thought leadership. So we're not focusing on newspaper op-ed pages per se. What we do is we train people to make a powerful argument, number one. Number two, we connect them with people who are able to support and review. And number three, we provide contact and submission information for all kinds of forums that they can submit to. And we show them how to pitch.
The project holds trainings in six cities and has more than 3,000 graduates from diverse backgrounds. They have published hundreds of op-eds.
It's very hard to wake up and run for Congress. It's not very hard to wake up and write an op-ed, and that is what lines you up to do future things and creates a kind of cascade. The publications are not really the end result. The end result is what happens afterwards. People have gotten book contracts, founded nonprofits. There's one woman who's become a national spokeswoman. Women have spoken on television and radio nationally and internationally. One woman briefed Congress. Her op-ed was used to brief Congress.
For more information about the op-ed project, go to theoped.org.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. I come to you live today, Sunday, November 1st, 2009. Our guest today, someone who's been on the program many times before, is a producer, director, and political activist, founder and president of Brave New Films. Robert Greenwald, our guest, has made 55, no less than 55 TV movies, miniseries, and feature films in his career in Hollywood prior to turning... Hello, Robert, are you there? Hello, Robert Greenwald. Well, our guest is, we're making our contact with Robert, and while we do, I will...
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, you are there. Very good. I was in the midst of a glowing introduction of you, Robert, and you cut me off because of your modesty, no doubt. Well, let me cut it off then and just say that most of our listeners, I suspect, are familiar with your work at Brave New Films and all the political documentaries you've done in the past 10 years. And I was just glowing about your career prior to that, making TV films and miniseries and feature films. But Robert, let's get right down to business if we can, because I want to talk about Brave New Films, your group that you founded, which makes the documentaries, which in many ways is revolutionizing or certainly leading to a new model of political discourse and filmmaking, taking advantage of new technologies. In the program today, it's one of the themes, but I want to start by talking, Robert Greenwald, about your new project on Afghanistan, why you're doing it, where it's at this point, and what your take on Afghanistan is, and have a discussion of that. So why don't you just talk about Rethink Afghanistan, if you would, Robert.
Sure. Well, I went to Afghanistan in March, and prior to that, we'd begun work actually in January, for a couple of reasons that came together. First and most importantly, it seemed that the decision to treat deep, profound problems, which are social and economic and educational, with a military invasion was a significant and tragic mistake, number one. Number two, we were in January when we started our work on Rethink Afghanistan, was at a period of time when many people incorrectly believed that we should not do anything that in any way disagreed with President Obama. Our argument at the time and continues to be the worst thing you could possibly do for the hopes and dreams of progressives and for the Obama administration would be to remain silent, because then all you have is pressure and from the right, whether it be health care or the military generals in Afghanistan. So those were the sort of driving forces, combined with the fact that I had just recently both visited Vietnam and reread The Best and the Brightest, David Halverson's brilliant book. And literally there were sentences and paragraphs that word for word seemed appropriate and relevant to what some very smart people in the Obama administration were advocating and pushing for, and which as early as January seemed to us a disastrous policy and has only been further borne out by events.
So you were just in Afghanistan fairly recently, Robert?
Fairly recently, yeah. I mean, things changed there pretty quickly. But yes, I was there, I think it was in the late March, and the idea was, and this sort of goes to our constantly pushing the boundaries on distribution. When we started the project, there were a few, three or four or five fundamental questions. And what we decided to do was take each one of those key questions, troops, Pakistan, women, civilian casualties, cost of war, and build a section around that. Now, at the time, we didn't think it would become a full film, or we never thought we'd have the resources to. And what we did, frankly, because when we started in January, we lost some major funders who were unhappy. People from our email list unsubscribed. So we would fundraise, we would edit, we would interview, and we would put out one section free online. And then from that, we would continue to work. We called it a real-time documentary, because as soon as it was up, we'd then go on to another section. Part of that was driven by necessity, but of you know, not having the resources. But part of it also is we didn't even want to wait a few months because policy was being shaped so immediately that we wanted to have out a 10-minute piece with Basevich and Kinzer and Pape and all kinds of experts talking about the fact that troops wouldn't solve the problem. Well, we wanted to have out a whole section of talking to women in Afghanistan about the fact that, in fact, troops were not making their life better.
Robert Greenwald, there's one question I've always... I had a discussion with a friend of mine not too long ago who basically thought that the Obama administration course on Afghanistan was the correct one. And I just asked him offhand, and I've asked this rhetorically to some extent, but also earnestly, when exactly is the right time for these troops to leave, if not now? Where down the road is it going to be the appropriate time to reduce the troops or pull them all out of Afghanistan and not have an American presence in that country? What conditions have to change? And he couldn't really give me an answer. At least I couldn't find one in there. Is there an answer to that that comes from proponents of the war?
No, there's not. And this is the sad thing, Bob, but it's also, I think, what gives us hope. Because, again, this is not an ideological war like Iraq. There are some very intelligent people. But you ask them that question. What is the exit strategy? How do we know when it's time to leave? There's no answer. You ask them, how many troops will it take? Nobody knows. 40,000 now, 60,000 later. Counterinsurgency numbers would have us at 500,000 or 600,000. You ask them, what is the cost? How much are we prepared to spend? There isn't an answer. And then fundamentally, if this is about United States security, and United States security is threatened by al-Qaeda, well, Petraeus has said al-Qaeda is not there. The administration has said maybe there are 100 members of al-Qaeda. So you mean to tell me we're going to invade a country, spend billions of dollars to possibly find 100 or less bad guys? There have to be better and more efficient ways of doing that.
And on that point about al-Qaeda, my sense is there are many more al-Qaeda in many other countries around the world. And if we're just invading countries on the basis of tracking down the bad guys, Afghanistan might not even be the first country on the list.
No, we should probably start with Spain or Great Britain or maybe Florida, where they were, planning 9/11. I mean, this is why it's such a fundamentally preposterous idea. Yes, you absolutely have to do and take action around terrorism, but the notion going after terrorists, but the notion that you invade and occupy Muslim countries, entire countries, as a way of making us more safe, is at its core an idea that doesn't make sense. And I think there's some hopefulness because there are intelligent people in the Obama administration. There are people who do not buy into the notion that for every problem there is a military solution. Our job is to create the pressure and create the force and keep forcing these questions.
Robert Greenwald, our guest today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580. Robert Greenwald is a filmmaker, documentary maker, founder of Brave New Films, has made numerous films on Afghanistan, on health care, on the political system, on Fox News. We've had him on the program on Walmart, Iraq for sale, on war profiteering. The list goes on and on. It's quite a body of work. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment for Robert Greenwald, the number here at WILL is 333-9455. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. Robert Greenwald, on this question of Afghanistan, you know, in Iraq, we always wondered what exactly motivates this war, since there weren't weapons of mass destruction, since there was no link to Al-Qaeda with Saddam Hussein. What drove it? And we looked at things like geopolitical concerns or wanting to take over the oil or neoconservative fantasies about regional domination. That's the logical question in Afghanistan, if there's just a handful of Al-Qaeda people there and certainly many more in several other countries, including Pakistan. What would drive seemingly rational people to be proponents of spending what looks like, at current plans, hundreds of billions of dollars over the next decade to occupy this country?
Well, I think that's a really good question. And if people go, by the way, to rethinkafghanistan.com, one of the sections is on security, and I think it goes into that question somewhat. But here's the answer that I would give, and it's not something that a lot of us have thought about, but this situation is forcing us to think it through. If you go to a surgeon, what kind of solution is he going to suggest? Most of the time, it's going to be surgery. The only people we're going to with the problems right now is the military. So the discussion is it 100 troops or 100,000 troops? I don't see economists sitting at that table. I don't see healthcare experts sitting at that table. I don't see educators sitting at that table, all of which are huge problems for Afghanistan if we're concerned about helping them. And if the issue is just security, even then, it's such a narrow framework that the discussion has so far been happening in. So you have all kinds of military people. And every problem that you present to them, they're going to present a military solution.
You know, Robert, I think, though, over the last 8 years, one of the things that had emerged in American politics was that there was a fairly substantial retired officer corps, because when officers are in active duty, they're not supposed to take political positions. But there was a strong retired officer corps that was quite critical of the Iraq invasion, and sort of following the Andrew Bacevich and Chalmers Johnson approach, somewhat critical of the United States invading all sorts of countries around the world, military people who talked about it not being helpful to national security. Aren't any of those people in the room when President Obama's talking about Afghanistan, or are all those people sort of exiled?
Well, right now, none of those people are in the room, and at least from the reports that we're hearing of people who are in the room, or work for people who are in the room, maybe better stated, Hillary Clinton has been shamefully very aggressive about the military solution, I guess, and which is where you would hope State Department would offer an alternative, right? That's theoretically they're the Department of State, not the Department of War, but that does not seem to be the case right now. And her trip to Pakistan with comments, she was asked a very tough question, a very good question about, do you consider drones terrorism? And, you know, just looking at the clip, the whole attitude of unhappiness about being even asked the question. But I think that the Baseviches of the world and the others, that's where our job comes in. Basevich is in Rethink Afghanistan. He went and testified before the Kerry Commission, before the Foreign Relations Commission headed by Kerry. We've been able to get various veterans. In fact, we've been fundraising and we're sending 3 to 5 veterans to D.C. today so that next week they can be there both to do press, to meet with representatives, and to be a counterforce to some pro-war veterans who are coming on Thursday. So I think that it's leaves lots of work for us to sort of get these voices out there. Our job at Brave New Films, get them in the media, and then we look to all of your listeners and others around the country to get it into the local newspapers, blogs. We've had over 700 screenings already of the film. I hope there'll be more of them. So there's lots we can do, and I think it's important that people understand it's time to take action, and it's really now is a critical time.
Robert, what is that website for people who want to go see the available cuts from Rethink Afghanistan?
It's rethinkafghanistan.com, and you can see each one of the clips. As I say, there's a section on troops, on Pakistan, on women. There's a heartbreaking section on civilian casualties. The day I was literally leaving Kabul, somebody emailed me or found me on Facebook and met me at the airport, said, I have to meet you, a young Afghan man. And he gave me this footage of the civilian camps where you see a father saying, I have to sell my daughter because I can't afford to pay for her, that comprised a whole section of civilian casualties. Then we have former CIA experts and former CIA guys, including Bob Baer, talking about this from a security point of view. So there's and then cost of war, which is an issue that we want to spend a lot of time on over the next few months. People have no idea how much money we're spending over there. And at a time with no jobs and people losing their homes, I think it's an area of extreme importance and, frankly, vulnerability from the pro-war side.
Our guest, Robert Greenwald, who you've just been listening to. Our number here, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. We already have a couple of listeners wanting to talk with Robert Greenwald, so let's go to the phone lines right now. Let's start with line one, Champaign County. You're on the air.
Hi, another military person to look at. I don't know if you mentioned the guy from the State Department, but he was ex-military, the first person to resign. There's another Lieutenant Colonel, I guess, Daniel Davis, who just tantamount to resign because he issued a contrary strategy to McChrystal. It's synopsized as the go-deep strategy, roughly the counter-terrorism as opposed to counterinsurgency, which I think is also a dead end, but it could be at least tactically used to derail the escalation for a time, it seems, until something else could come up. And that something else would be a grand bargain between not just low-level Taliban, but between the states and peoples in the region, as outlined by a number of different groups, but still not getting much traction. You included Tariq Ali in the cuts that I saw, and I think that, well, Bob, you, with Monthly Review, published the Mirage of the Good War, Afghanistan, which was enhanced and put in his book called The Duel. And his assessment is that, you know, it's really the great game. It's really we want to have the U.S., the powers that be, want to have bases in that region to control which way the natural gas goes and to watch over the Central Asian states and China and as well. And that is the root of it that needs to be, I think, expressed from time to time. I understand that it gets one dismissed as anti-American, et cetera, but and if tactically maybe it's not the best strategy to make, but some people have to make that argument because there is, I think, a broader thing. Of course, the military juggernaut of the complex has its own inertia, but it's there, and we have 700 bases or more, 900 around the world, not just because of inertia, but because there are resources and politics, grand area strategy at stake. So I hope you respond to that, and thanks all for all your great work.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Robert Greenwald?
Well, excuse me. I'm going to be interviewing the gentleman who resigned Tuesday morning, Matthew Ho. So it'll be hopefully... And we're going to capture it on our video conferencing system.
You know, that story's gotten a bit of attention in the press. Could you, for listeners of ours who might not be familiar with Matthew Ho's story, could you just give a little bit of background?
He was someone who was in Afghanistan and who came face-to-face with the policies and said that he was planning to resign. They flew him to D.C. to try to talk him out of resigning, and he wrote the most beautiful and eloquent letter about the reasons that the war cannot work. And as he said, I'm no hippie, pot-smoking, person, but somebody who's been in the military for a long time, and yet he sees this as everything wrong and deeply harmful to U.S. Security interests. And again, that's one of the arguments we're making right now strongly, because for those who believe in this, it seems to fall into a few camps. One is the idea that we're there to save the women. The notion that the U.S. Army is leading a feminist revolution boggles the mind. And the other is that it's helping our security. So we're trying to undercut that very clearly with rational arguments. And if you go to rethinkafghanistan.com, sign up on any one of the lists, and we're hoping that we'll have the clip with Matthew out to everybody on Wednesday.
Our guest today on the phone, you've just been heard, is Robert Greenwald. We're talking about his new film, Rethink Afghanistan, and we'll be talking about all the work he's been doing at Brave New Films over the course of the show. Let's go back to the phone lines right now to our next caller. Line 4, Chicago, you're on there with Robert Greenwald.
Yes, I'd like to know how the question of Secretary of State Baker making the statement that we have a foreign policy that states we will go to war in order to maintain our access to oil. And this is an underlying factor that's from the beginning in Iraq and the Middle East and other parts to transport the oil and other resources and so forth. But you just touched upon it briefly. Could you expand a little bit more on the fact that we seem to still have this policy in place?
Robert, take over.
Well, there's the articulated policy, and then there's sort of the way the bureaucracy functions. It's one of the things that Halberstam talks about in his book so well. A bureaucracy kind of has a mind of its own and has a pursuit of its own. Certainly, I don't think there's any conspiratorial or hidden nature to the fact that the United States sees oil as central to its continued function and therefore will go into areas where it feels that its access to oil is threatened. But I would take it slightly step larger, which is that seems to me that any time U.S. national security is in question, whether it's oil, some terrorists, a country whose behavior we don't like, we've moved towards this notion that the solution is invasion and sending in U.S. troops. That's a disastrous, tragic idea, which has not worked. Look at the extraordinary failure with this policy of trying to solve all these problems with militarism. And I think that as progressives, it's a big part of our job to stop the escalation in Afghanistan, but also to connect the dots for people, let them know the terrible toll that this war machinery is taking on our lives, on our country, on our economy every single day.
Robert Greenwald, before we go back to the phone lines to the callers who are waiting patiently, and you've really generated a lot of interest among our listeners, I was a little concerned. I'd like to get your response to see General McChrystal sort of publicly advocating a particular position for the Afghan war in a way sort of pressuring the president to go in his direction and putting public lobbying almost. Yeah, with something which has traditionally been frowned upon in the United States by the military to do anything like that. In fact, the last time I can recall something along those lines was General MacArthur, who was immediately fired then by President Truman. Am I making too much out of General McChrystal's advocacy of increased troops for Afghanistan?
No, not at all. And from talking with people in D.C. and elected officials, and also people at, were closely connected to the administration, they were furious about Crystal's very overt campaign on 60 Minutes, on the speech in London, and apparently there was a response. I mean, we saw it in the papers where McChrystal was slapped down by both Gates and Jones, I think it was. But no, he was going outside the job of what military people are supposed to do, which is to work and implement the policy set by the elected officials, not the policy set by the military and what they decide is right. So I think that hopefully the Obama administration will continue to be vigilant and not respond to that pressure. And when it's public in that way, will continue to be very clear that that is not the appropriate role for the military. But it's certainly, I think, Bob, a good warning to all of us about how far the military has come and how little outcry there was about the fundamental violation of the military-civilian relationship.
Yeah, along those lines, and I don't want to dwell on this, but it's sort of orthogonal to much of what we're talking about. But it seems, that we hear hue and cry constantly that, 81% of college professors are liberals or Democrats or not Republican or some other figure like that, and how that's a threat to the future of humanity, that politically they're not balanced on the middle. But I never hear anyone bellyaching that, all these generals seem to be extreme far right wingers, and they actually control all the military.
Yes, and are having a, a very negative effect, not just, again, with specific policy, but almost internalized by the media and by many of the pundits that there is a military solution. So, again, we've been pushing very hard to reframe the debate, not in terms of 1,000 troops or 100,000 troops, but in terms of what is the problem and what are ways to solve them. And if you look at the problem, whether it be the people of Afghanistan or the Taliban or security, there are a series of solutions, but they are not militaristic solutions. And in the Rethink Afghanistan film and the different sections, you will see that articulated different ways, and most importantly, by many people in Afghanistan. One of the many tragedies with Iraq was we never heard from Iraqis, and we vowed with our Afghanistan work that we would not let that happen again.
Well, I don't want to suggest, in the point I was getting at, Robert, there were at a 7 days in May moment or a political coup, but at the same time, I do want to suggest that, you know, it's a little unseemly. The pressure that we seem to be getting from McChrystal and the Pentagon brass is more or less a publicly, either you go along with us or we're going to make your life a living hell for the next 3 years.
No, I think there's no question about that. And the political people in the White House, from what we've been reading, Axelrod and Rahm Emanuel, have been pushing back on this pretty hard. Because, I mean, you talk about a political hell, it's 2010. There are elections all over the country, 10% unemployment, 9% unemployment, X million of people have lost their homes, and you have billions of dollars going to this war that is not popular now. Can you imagine a year from today, if there's an escalation, there'll be 1,000 American soldiers have been injured over there already? It's a terrible, the political folks holding morality aside for a minute and proper strategy, just people whose job it is to get Democrats elected in 2010 have to be damn nervous about this.
Our guest, Robert Greenwald. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Come to you live on WILL AM 580. Robert Greenwald, the filmmaker, head of Brave New Films. We're talking about the newest film, Rethink Afghanistan. There are other films I'd love to talk about, including Sick for Profit, the recent work on the healthcare industry. The number here at Media Matters, if you care to join us, is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to the phone lines now to a couple of callers who have been waiting very patiently. Let's start with line one. Peoria, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi. I was going to make a comment because I heard something on the on an earlier program on 580 where the one of the journalists in Chicago who decided to air the video of the teenager who was beaten to death on the street, and they acquired that video. And she was talking about the process of making the decision to air it, and what they were and the considerations they took. And one of the comments she made was that by airing this, that this young man, if they didn't air it, he would just be another statistic. And it struck me as, you know, you're talking to Mr. Greenwald as a filmmaker, that our, you know, every day we just see 7 Marines killed in Afghanistan or something like that. It just struck me listening to that their motivation for airing that was to keep this from just being another statistic. And that's just the comment I had.
Any comments you want to make on that, Robert?
No, I think it's said very well.
Well, let me ask you this, Robert. How would you grade the press coverage of the debate over what to do in Afghanistan going on right now? How well informed are the average American who watches, reads their daily newspaper, if there is one left, or watches the evening news? What are they equipped to make an informed decision?
Well, I think that the press in its – certainly some of the print reporters are really trying. I mean, we're not getting the one-sided, everything is going great coverage the way we got around Iraq for a while, nor are we getting the one-sided, we must go to war or we will die tomorrow coverage. Now, there are some challenges. One of them is Afghanistan is incredibly dangerous. Reporters are kidnapped and killed, and it's very hard for white-skinned reporters to get outside the city. I could not go outside Kabul. The security would not, the folks that I was working with would not allow me to. So that's certainly a limitation, although occasionally, if you'll notice the byline, the New York Times or the Post or the AP will get somebody outside of Kabul, but it's increasingly difficult to do. The bigger challenge has been, and this was, you're reminding me, this was the other reason that I started this project in January. I remember reading an article in the Times, and in an article, not an opinion piece, it talked about the fact everyone agrees that troops are needed to solve the problem, something to that effect. Well, I think that we've been part of a significant pushback so that we're expanding the debate. We're still not there, and if you do the numbers of, you know, generals and people who are on, the debate is still too narrow. Again, is it counterinsurgency or counterterrorism? Is it, you know, troops now or troops tomorrow, rather than fundamentally looking at the problem of how do you solve some of these issues?
Let's go back to the phone lines now. Our guest again, Robert Greenwald. Let's go to line two. Kankakee, you're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I was recently at a dinner at McGill in Florida, in Tampa, and a colonel was giving a report on Iraq and Afghanistan, and I was absolutely, I couldn't, you know, it wasn't the appropriate place to stand up and you know, wave a protest flag, but certainly, you know, he in fact made the reference. When he was talking about Iraq, that the connection between 9/11 and Iraq was a reality, and if that's what the military and from CENTCOM is where they run that war from, if that's the attitude that those people have, they'll never get out of there. I mean, it's hopeless, and I was just so appalled at the fact that, you know, this person is working for us. And he still doesn't get it, you know. And I think if the president administration, which I strongly supported, cannot muster the nerve and the sense of reality to get out of these two wars before the election, I think he's going to be a one-term president.
That's an excellent comment, caller. What do you think, Robert Greenwald? Is Obama flirting with disaster here?
Yes. There's no question. Again, the good news is he's got some very smart political people around him, forgetting about what's the right policy. And as I was outlining before, if this war significantly escalates, we're seeing Americans killed and injured in significant numbers. The Afghans will not be, sadly, an electoral issue, but that will happen also. And the most critically, or equally critically, will be this huge expenditure. That is not a change administration in any shape or form, and I think we will see huge problems. We just interviewed a young man yesterday who's back probably 3-4 weeks from Afghanistan, and again, we'll be, if you sign up to get the emails, or you sign up on Facebook, we're going to be putting that video out next week. He talks about being over there, and he said, we didn't know what our mission is. He said, were we over there to capture Osama bin Laden? He said people had no idea, troops, what we were doing there.
Our guest, Robert Greenwald. I'm Bob McChesney. The phone line's open here at Media Matters at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Robert, you've done a lot of work over the last 6 or 7 years on the Iraq War and sort of lost in both the healthcare battles and the Afghan war has been what's been going on in Iraq, where we still have a few troops, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
What's your sense of what's going on in Iraq now, and are you happy with the course the Obama administration is pursuing?
Well, I think the troops are continuing to be withdrawn. I would like them to get out faster, but they're being drawn down. I think the big problem in Iraq will be the size and scope of the military bases and the number of contractors. I was on a panel with Jeremy Scahill. We were discussing Rethink Afghanistan after one of the screenings, and Jeremy pointed out there are more private contractors in Afghanistan than there are troops. Again, this is the Obama administration.
And if I can interrupt you just to be clear on this, by private contractors, these are people who in Vietnam, for example, would have been troops. These are privatized jobs.
Right, exactly. Well, and every conceivable privatized job, from providing food to the people who are pushing the buttons on the drones, to people who are doing interrogation, to people who are providing security for some of the ambassadors who go over there, Blackwater being most infamously that people know about.
So if you include them in the tally, then you're looking at 300,000 or 350,000 troops.
Totally, yes.
Which is getting us into, like, you know, Vietnam turf.
Yeah. If you include them, you include the NATO troops, and you include our troops, absolutely. And when I was in Kabul, by the way, one day my friends and colleagues said, you've got to see this neighborhood. And I said, why? What is it? He said, well, we call it, the area is called narcotecture, for narcotics architecture. And they drove me through an area right next to starving people, by the way, because it is the third poorest country in the world. And there was mansion after mansion, every single one with armed guards and barbed wire. And it wasn't just drug dealers. It was private contractors, and it was corrupt officials from the Karzai government, all living right next to each other in probably this 20-block area. And I shot a little DVD of it that we put up on the video also.
It sounds like driving through Beverly Hills or Bel Air.
Yeah. That's what they said. They said it's our Beverly Hills, only far worse because of the number of security guards and the size of those cement walls and the barbed wire encasing all of them.
Yeah, more like Johannesburg then, maybe.
Yeah.
Well, let us go back to the phone lines right now. Our guest, Robert Greenwald, this is Media Matter. Let's go to line one, Champagne. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for all your wonderful work with Brave New Films, and thank you, Mr. McChesney, for your wonderful program. I have a question about advice you might give to filmmakers working in a similar vein. What advice do you have for documentary filmmakers who have developed exceptional content in terms of research and video content and who are contributing to the discourse on important social, political, and economic issues and yet need additional financial post-production and promotion and distribution support for delivering the important works?
Well, thank you very much, caller. I suspect, Robert Greenwald, you've heard this question before.
Yes, it's a tough one, unfortunately. Raising funds takes a huge amount of my time and two of my colleagues, and we raise it in a variety of different ways. Fortunately, there are about 15,000 people who give us from $5 to $100 a month to allow the work to keep going. We have people who support individual campaigns by buying DVDs to Rethink Afghanistan that lets us continue the work. We go to foundations on certain projects. We have larger donors on certain projects. But it is very, very tough. It's probably the hardest part of my job, and the one that is the one where the frustration level can be the highest, because particularly when you're doing important work. I wish that I had some specific answers that were really helpful. I guess the only thing, maybe the specific thing I would say, is to focus on the issue that you're working on and to try to find individuals or donors who are also interested in that to see if you can get their support.
Robert Greenwald, if I can turn to another area you've worked on in your career, you've done a lot of critical work on Fox News and their coverage of various issues and their caliber of journalism in general. And I just wanted to ask you if you're surprised by how, after the Republican Party has now been trounced in two consecutive national elections, the first political party to be so trounced since the Republicans in the 1930s during the New Deal, that Fox News still has what seems to be such extraordinary power sort of setting the discussion points of the nation.
I think I'm surprised by the fact that they've openly and overtly moved from the pretense of a news channel that you and others and we all have been talking about for years to really a organizer of rallies. And I think in crossing that line, they will ultimately hurt themselves in the way that they're most impactful. And we must remember, it's not the couple of million people who watch Fox News. That's never been the issue. as you just said, Bob, the issue is they're affecting the agenda and the discourse. But there's a lot of pushback going on now. You know, we've been doing it. The News Hounds, a wonderful site, which their slogan is, "We watch Fox so you don't have to." Media Matters has done extraordinary work. So I think it's going to take a little bit of time, and I think the Obama administration being very clear in calling them out is a terrific and important step. It's going to be harder and harder for other news organizations to look at Fox and say, oh, wait, they have that story on, therefore we should also run it.
You know, I know that News Hounds watches Fox, so you don't have to, Robert, but I'm just wondering if you've ever watched this Glenn Beck show?
Well, we're working on something around Glenn Beck, so I've had the displeasure of having to watch it the last week or so. It's quite something.
How would you, I mean, I've had the pleasure, or whatever noun, adjective one wants to use to describe the process of watching the program, too. How would you compare that sort of Beck stuff with, you know, the traditional conservative media of the last 10 or 20 years? I mean, is this more of the same, or are we heading into like some new territory here?
Well, I think it's more of the same in that the appeal is fundamentally emotional and paranoid. One of my colleagues, Leighton Woodhouse, who's the political director at Brave New Films, has been doing some memos recently in which he says that what Beck is really smart at is going to fundamental issues. So, example, on climate change, he's not getting worried about, you know, is the temperature going up 2 degrees or not. It's become an issue of the sovereignty of the United States of America, that his fundamental framing is very good for a conservative and a right-wing audience. His delivery is, I think, laughable, but it's clearly working in terms of a large and passionate audience that follows him.
Robert Greenwald, you've also worked on healthcare. Your film was Sick for Profit, is that right?
Yes, we did five different Sick for Profits, actually, which are all available at sickforprofit.com.
Have you had a chance to follow the healthcare debates, or have you been too enmeshed in Afghanistan to really look at that very closely?
I followed it quite closely as we were doing the Sick for Profit work. So I think the answer is yes. Now, we focused on a particular aspect because one of the decisions always at Brave New Films is what is not being done, and what had not been done when we started was every storyline needs an enemy, and there's a clear enemy here, which is the insurance companies and the greed. And so we went after the extraordinary obscene pay of the CEOs, and not just because they were making so much money, but because the way they make money is by rejecting your claim. And that's a very important connect the dots that people understand. Insurance companies are in business to take your money and not provide you health care. That's how they profit. That's how their stock goes up.
What's your sense of how matters stand right now in Washington with regard to health care?
Well, it seems that eventually they're going to get a bill, and there'll be some version of the public option in the bill. The problem that others have pointed out is that unless there are greater cost controls built in, that we could be in the horrible situation of Democrats having 30 to 35 more million people getting health care, but getting it within private insurance companies, therefore having to pay more and no relief for that. And I gather that's where some of the policy folks are struggling now to try to come to terms with, both, again, on the moral level and also on pure politics. Can you imagine future elections if health care goes through and 30, 35 million people wind up paying more than they've ever had to pay for it before?
I know that one of the debates in the Democratic camp in the Obama administration has been on precisely this issue. How far can you have – you have to pass something, and it has to be called reform, and it's got to have a few goodies in there. But how much can you avoid pissing off the insurance companies, for lack of a better term, and their advocates in Capitol Hill without fearing that you won't get enough votes from the left or the progressive flank of the Democratic Party to get something passed? And, I mean, is there a point at which you would say to something the Obama administration supported, this isn't good enough, if this passes, it'll make the situation worse? Or are you of a mind that anything that passes that will improve anything at all is better than doing nothing?
No, I don't think anything at all. I think if the bill is passed, that gives more support to the insurance companies and more profit and no controls, we essentially are not helping people out. And that's the reason that we all got into this fight.
Our guest today, Robert Greenwald, who you've just been listening to, been listening to the whole hour. I'm Bob McChesney. This is Media Matters here in WILL AM 580. Thank you for joining us. We've got about 10 minutes left if anyone wants to call in at 333-9455 or toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Robert, talk a little bit about Brave New Films, if you would. I mean, how big of an operation is it? How do you pick topics? How are you distributing your work?
Well, we're about 30 people right now, and we're very different than studios, except we're divided structurally the way a studio is. We have people who, producers, associate producers, editors, post-production people who work on the content. We have people who work just on distribution, which is becoming increasingly important, which is how do you find and build an audience in a universe of so many choices, and they've been doing an amazing job of that in the last couple of months, both with Afghanistan and the Sick for Profit, and our weekly Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders show. Then we have a press department that, because, again, we never have money for advertising, that works on figuring out where are the opportunities to get, whether it's a blogger or the New York Times, to write about it. And then we have the political department headed by Leighton Woodhouse that I mentioned before that works in terms of strategies, coordination with other groups. We have a particular and specific role to play, whether it's films or foundation. Oh, and then we have, of course, the most important of all, the fundraising folks, because without them, the rest of the team doesn't exist. But the political department, you know, works very carefully, too, with partner groups, because our job as a media company is to tell a story and put a spotlight on it. We will never be and never should be the on-the-ground group. So we partner often with, whether it's SEIU or Move On or, you know, whoever it might be, to make sure that the work we do has the most value to the progressive movement and the biggest number of partners, depending on the issue. We did an Acorn video last week pushing back on the smear attacks on Acorn. So we went out with it. Acorn went out with it. Other groups will be Campaign for America's Future will be sending it out. You know, so we're constantly looking to figure out when we decide how to take something on. Number one, is it a story we can tell? You know, there were certain stories that are better done, if you will, by think tanks or economists, data-driven stuff. There are other things where they lend themselves to to media and to our telling the story. And then we figure out, well, if we're going to do healthcare, as I was saying before, how do we do it that hasn't been done with so much going on, or, you know, any number of issues, looking at making sure we're adding to the discourse, we're giving another perspective. And then one of the things we try to do, although we don't talk about it too much because it's not of interest to most people, but it's to try to connect the dots, because I think that political success for progressives is based on having a worldview, so that everything is not an individual battle about a traffic light at this corner or, you know, impeaching someone in that district, but connecting the dots around fundamental core issues, you know, private corporations, the profit system, the military machine, how all of that affects a variety of decisions. So we're doing that more and more, trying to do it in ways that still make the videos or the films compelling and emotional. But I think it would be malpractice if we didn't do more of that, so that people understand, particularly as we're building a larger and larger audience. And I think we just passed cumulatively 48 million views for all of our short videos online the last couple of years, by the way.
That's extraordinary.
Yeah.
That's absolutely really extraordinary.
Just been amazing. So the responsibility that comes with that, I believe, is to take it a step further and not be stuck in the ghetto of single issues, if you will, or single limited issues, but keep connecting the dots in ways that help give people a framework to look at all of this.
Let's go back to our phone lines now for another caller who will speak with Robert Greenwald. Let's now go to line one. Champagne, you're on the air.
Yes. A few minutes ago, you spoke about the Beverly Hills-type neighborhood on the outskirts of Kabul, where lots of government officials, drug traffickers, contractors live. It's been in the news recently that even in Kabul itself, there's been lots of bombs and other violence. And I'm wondering whether this neighborhood ever comes under rocket fire or mortar fire or anything like that.
So far, it has not. When I read about the UN attacks, where they went and attacked a UN workers who were staying at a guest house, I was kind of looking to see if it was this neighborhood. But I've been assured by my friends and colleagues over there that because it is contractors, corrupt officials, and drug traffickers, that it will probably never be attacked. A lot of the attacks in Kabul, by the way, are not just the bombing attacks. When I was over there and, you know, I had not fully comprehended what an issue security was, is also the kidnapping. And it's considered by everyone over there that the kidnapping is their members of the Karzai government who are involved in that as a profit-making scheme. And by the way, on the, you know, as I was saying before, if you get the DVD of Rethink Afghanistan, we posted on that DVD my video of the narcotecture. It's just a couple of minutes, but it really gives you a feel and a look and puts a picture to the words.
Now, let's for those who have pen and paper handy, let's give some web addresses if they want to follow up on today's program, Robert. Your personal website, which has links to everything, if I'm not mistaken, is simply robertgreenwald.org.
Yeah, or bravenewfilms.org.
Or bravenewfilms.org. And then if what we've been talking about, Rethink Afghanistan, has its own website at rethinkafghanistan.com. .com. Okay.
Yeah.
So those are the websites to go to do follow-up work on this. Robert,
also, you know, people are free to, we have groups on Facebook. You can follow me on Facebook or others on Facebook, on Twitter. You know, we're using everything. So depending on how you like to interact, we've got a Rethink Afghanistan Facebook presence also.
Robert, we've only got a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you, you know, you gave up a very successful career as a film director and producer. You won the American Film Institute Producer of the Year Award in 2002, and I'm just wondering if any of your friends from the old world in Hollywood, directors, actors, producers, have talked to you and said, you know, we're really sort of interested in doing what you're doing. This is pretty exciting, and are we going to see more talented people from the creative community moving into documentary work, or are you basically out there on your own?
Well, I would say almost the entire team at Brave New Films has come from the commercial world. Some have been editors, some have producers, some have researchers. And then we're also getting folks from the labor movement, too. Our head of press comes from the labor movement. You know, I was fortunate in that I worked a long time in the commercial world. I made an extraordinarily good living, and I was able to become a full-time volunteer. A lot of people aren't able to do that, and frankly, the salaries are always going to be much higher in the commercial world, so I don't know how many people will either have the desire or the stomach for it. But I'll tell you, every day I'm hearing, like the woman who called in before, people who are making a film or have a documentary or somebody who's, we have probably 30, 40 people volunteering and helping us now who can't do it full time, but give us 5, 6, 7 hours a week. And that's something else. People can go to Brave New Films and they'll see posted whole series, and they don't need to be in Los Angeles where we need volunteers to help fill out certain projects. So I think that, you know, I would look at it as, part of our job is to offer as many ways for as many people to get involved as possible.
You know, Robert Greenwald, I hear the band tuning up in the background, which means they want to clear me out of the studio. So I want to thank you for taking an hour out of your very busy schedule and probably one of the few days you might get off in the course of a year to join us here at Media Matters. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. Thank you and all your listeners who've been so great in taking the work and using it to organize with.
Well, good luck with everything. And I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board, Melissa Trentz for being my producer. And next week, we're going to have Mark Contreras from the Newspaper Association of America talking about the future of journalism and newspapers. Should be a great show. See you all in 167 hours.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly sunny skies this afternoon with a high around 54. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low of 40. Monday, partly sunny skies with a high of 59. Monday night, partly cloudy with a low around 35. And Tuesday, sunny with a high of 51. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.